The Best and Overlooked Books of 2014. You know what they say? So many books, so little time. It's true. Consider this. In 2013, traditional publishers released more than 300,000 new titles in the English language, and there were even more self-published books in 1 year. How on earth to cull through the torrent and choose what to read? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we have outstanding literary luminaries here to help us. Pulitzer Prize winner Richard Russo, novelist and Penn Faulkner Award winner Kate Christensen, and Bill Lundgren, bookseller, blogger, and teacher. We'd love for you to join the discussion. What books this year won your highest praise? What books are you giving your friends or in-laws this holiday season? Or are you looking for book buying advice from our esteemed panel? Maine Calling is calling all bookworms. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. If you love to read, grab a pen or pencil and a piece of paper and get ready to add to your reading list. It is time for our annual Best and Overlooked Books show. Today, we'll hear about some best-selling books and some that didn't get the attention they deserve. We will also hear from you about the books you discovered in 2014 that you would like to tell others about. With me in the studio to share their best and overlooked books of 2014, Kate Christensen. She is the author of 6 novels, including The Epicure's Lament, the Penn Faulkner Award-winning The Great Man, and The Astral. Her most recent book is Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. Bill Lundgren is a bookseller at Longfellow Books and teaches at Southern Maine Community College. Rick Russo is the author of numerous books. His 2001 novel, Empire Falls, received the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Was that really 12 years ago? Wow. Of course, we want to hear from you. Which was the best book you read this year? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I can't believe that was 12 years ago, Rick, because maybe it's such a sign of such a fine novel as it feels as though I read it yesterday. So, or maybe I'm just...
It feels like 30 years ago to me.
Or maybe I'm just aging, right? So I want to start with you, Kate, though, because this past year you were a reader for the Kirkus Prize. And I want you to tell me about that experience. How is the Kirkus Prize awarded? How many books did you have to read? How did you evaluate them? Just tell us about it.
Well, first of all, this was the first year of the award's existence, and I was one of 3 judges. There was me, a fiction writer, and then there was a bookseller, Stephanie Valdez from Community Books in Brooklyn, and then there was the great Marion Winnick, who's a writer and a critic. And so they decided to set it up that way so that it would be sort of a variety of people judging it. I felt a huge sense of responsibility as boxes and boxes of books arrived on my doorstep, and the UPS, finally the UPS delivery person asked if I had a problem, a book addiction, and I had to say, no, I'm judging a contest. But it's funny. I don't know if you've judged a contest. It's like public reading, and usually reading is a very private, intimate act. But when you're judging a contest, I had to read a book and take all my own tastes into consideration, but also try to transcend them and think about the readership in general. And so there was a feeling of opening a book and having my own personal reaction, and then thinking in terms of my judges whose tastes were very varied, and the discussion that would be sure to ensue about this book. And then there was the sense of the prize itself and what Kirkus is. And of course, Kirkus is terrifying for a lot of authors, and getting a star in Kirkus is a big deal because they're known for being harsh critically, I think.
Mm-hmm. Isn't the Kirkus that libraries will generally buy the books that have the stars in the Kirkus reviews?
I think that's Library Journal.
Okay,
it's,
I'm sorry.
It's
yeah.
more geared. Okay. I think Kirkus is more geared toward booksellers and sort of literary excellence. They kind of hold up the standard of literary excellence. And at times it seems arbitrary. but reading these books, and every book that got a Kirkus star, every fiction book was eligible. So those are the books I read. And there were 300 and something of them. And they started coming in June, and they came until early October.
So you were reading several.
At what point did your eyes start bleeding?
They're still bleeding. But the thing about judging a contest is it's exciting when you find a winner. And there's this frisson of excitement that goes beyond just loving a book for yourself. There's a sense of yay. And Euphoria by Lily King won. And it was the early favorite, and no one beat it. And I was excited to see it on two 10 best of 2014 lists this morning.
Main author, Lily King.
Yes.
So how exciting is that? And every time we have a book show, that book comes up. Every time we talk books with authors, that comes up. So clearly that's going to be on everybody's list. Okay, so let's start with you, Bill. What's on your list for this year?
Oh, excuse me. I would begin with The Happiest People in the World by Brock Clark. Brock is a really intriguing writer because he has this madcap antic energy. But what the book his most recent book reminded me of was Puddinghead Wilson. And I realized after reading it, Brock sort of reminds me of Mark Twain. He has this really slyly subversive take on American culture that it's sort of beneath the surface of these crazy, crazy happenings in the book. And it's a really fun read, but it's also a read that you're going to ponder after you read it.
Okay, Rick, what's your number one?
Oh, it's tough. It's tough. So many, so many great books this year. The one that just for pure unalloyed entertainment the kind of book that when you put it down, you've had so much fun with it, and then you realize, oh, wait, in addition to entertaining, it was also really, really a fine novel. That book for me this year is Sarah Waters' The Paying Guests. It is, in its own strange way, very different story. It's a love story, which turns into a murder story, which turns into a courtroom drama. But what I loved most about it was that it is also a kind of period piece. It takes place right after the end of World War I. And in its own way, it's a little bit like Downton Abbey because England is changing at this period of time. As a matter of fact, the title itself, The Paying Guests, comes from the fact that the two main characters are involved in a rental arrangement. I mean, this woman and her mother don't know what to call what they're doing. They're renting the place out, but there's no language for that. They don't think of themselves as renting, so they refer to these people who have come into their house and are paying to be there as their paying guests. So you have this wonderful historical backdrop to it and fascinating to read now, too, because a lot of it hinges on all of these World War I vets coming back home to England and there's nothing for them to do. And they're blamed for virtually everything that happens in the country in the years after it. It's just a brilliant brilliant novel, I think.
Mm. And you're nodding away over there, Kate.
It's on my list, too. It was on the Kirkus shortlist. We chose six, of which Lily King was the winner. But Sarah Waters, The Paying Guest, was a very, very strong contender and made us talk a lot. First of all, it has really hot sex scenes in it.
It does.
I mean, let's just say that.
Yeah.
and like Rick says, it's a page turner.
Yeah.
It's long, but it's propulsive. And I felt it was no effort to read it all. I just enjoyed it tremendously. I think I read it in two sittings. I couldn't put it down. And I also felt, like Rick says, that it's about more than it seems. It's about class and change.
Yes.
And very interesting and made me think after I'd finished reading it, after the enjoyment.
Why do you think Sarah Waters isn't even more famous than she is? Because when you round up the Booker Prize finalists every year, it's mostly the usual suspects. And they're great writers, the Hilary Mantels of the world and Martin Amis if he's got a book out. But who's been writing better, more consistently than Sarah Waters over the last two decades?
That's
She's just a brilliant writer, and she doesn't get her due, I don't think.
I think she seems popular. I don't think people realize how literary she is.
Yeah, yeah.
I think she's dismissed too easily,
yeah.
And she's much better and more literary than one might think because her books are such page-turners.
Yeah.
Mm. And, so what about overlooked books? What are books that you were just sleepers, that maybe you picked up, Bill, off the shelves at Longfellow not knowing anything about and just fell in love with?
Well, I did know something about this book. It got a lot of really early buzz. And I'm always intrigued at the end of the year. I read these books and I think, wow, that's going to get a lot of recognition. And then they just disappear. And one of those books was Shotgun Love Songs by Nicholas Butler. It's a novel about four friends from high school returning to their little community in Wisconsin and the relationships that ensue. The most interesting piece about it is one of the characters is very clearly modeled on the indie icon Bon Iver. And it turns out that Nicholas Butler actually went to high school with Justin Vernon, who became Bon Iver. And in an interview, he talked about everybody's making too much of the character and who it's based on. What Justin really did for the kids of northern Wisconsin is he made it possible for them to conceptualize living the life of an artist. Because he would come back to the community and he financed the school band and he would play with them at holiday concerts. And he was a big deal. And the book is absolutely beautiful about these people going off to pursue their dreams and then coming back and sort of rebuilding and reestablishing their relationships with one another. And it didn't certainly get the recognition I thought that it would or the recognition that I thought it deserved.
Mm. So that Shotgun Love Songs by Nicholas Butler, all of these we'll put on our MPBN Main Calling Facebook page. What about you, Rick? Any discoveries this year?
The best first novel, I thought, of the year that I read, and I haven't read as much as I wanted to this year because I'm hard at work on a long overdue novel of my own. But there's a book by a young writer named Smith Henderson called Fourth of July Creek that just really blew the doors off. It's the work of a writer who's like a fifth or sixth novel. It's that good. It's a fascinating book. It takes place in the 70s in Montana. It's the story of a social worker named Pete who needs some help himself. And I think that's what really is the book is about. In the same way that very often, ironically, that it's poor people who are much more generous than rich people. This is a book about the ways in which I think those people who are most generous, those people who are in trouble themselves in some way, want to help other people. And Pete, who is probably the best social worker in Montana, during the course of this book, is also in deep trouble himself. And he has actually a daughter that's part of the social work system in Montana that he himself is a part of. It's a big book, very challenging, extraordinary first novel.
I want to touch on something you said earlier. You're not reading as much as you would like because you're writing. How does that work? I would almost wonder if some writers don't read at all while they're writing. Or do you find inspiration when you're reading? Or do you have to start some things and set them aside because this is does it mess with your writing to read?
Some writers don't read. I find that there are certain kinds of books that I don't like to read. And I will steer away from writers who are writing on the same subject matter. They're working in the same mind that I'm working in. And I will tend to read more writers who I admire, but who are hunting different game than I am in some way. And so I basically what I'm saying is that you know, I can admire their sentences. I can love what they're doing. I can admire them, but I don't feel like they're going to be encroaching. I'm not going to be encroaching on them, and they're not going to be encroaching on me.
Does it feel like work to be reading? I mean, I have to confess, sometimes I feel like watching the news is work because what I do for a living is news.
Yeah.
Does it feel like that as a writer? That because are you reading just to enjoy it, or are you analyzing it? You know, taking it, deconstructing it, figuring out is it work to read? I guess is my question.
I don't read for credit anymore. so if I, you know, I still have a hard time. I mean, even a bad book is really, it's really hard to write even a bad book, just like it's hard to make even a bad movie is hard to make. And so you come into it with a certain amount of admiration. But I'm 65 now, and I don't have time to read all the books that I want to read. And at 65, I don't give a book quite as long as I would have given it 15, 20 years ago when I knew I was going to live forever.
So if it's good, you allow yourself to enjoy it.
Oh, absolutely. And if I'm not enjoying it, I'll probably find something that I do.
And what about you, Kate? Do you read while you write?
I do. I read compulsively always. But it's funny. I know what you're talking about, Rick, when you talk about someone who's hunting different game. I almost want my brain to be taken away from my book when I read. I don't want to be reminded of it. I don't want to feel challenged by someone who did what I'm doing better or you know, in the same vein or, you know, or feel competitive. I want to feel, I want to escape. So I read really like a little kid when I'm writing.
Okay.
Whatever takes me away at Calgon.
And I know that all of our friend Monica Wood reads. I ran into her in front of Longfellow Books recently, Bill, and she had two shopping bags full of books. And I said, "Are you buying gifts?" She said, "No, these are all for myself." And so I know that you all are not alone. So we have to take a break. Oh, my goodness. But when we come back, we'll get to your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, committed to increasing recycling rates while reducing residential trash and landfill loads through zero-sort recycling, Casella, giving resources new life. Ocean View at Falmouth, an active retirement community offering independent apartments, cottages, and a care continuum, oceanviewrc.com. And Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainers' success, famemaine.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Josh Brolin. He co-stars in Paul Thomas Anderson's adaptation of Thomas Pynchon's novel, Inherent Vice. We'll talk about his movies, being the son of actor James Brolin, growing up on a ranch, then moving to Santa Barbara, where as a teenager he became part of a group of surfers and punk rockers known as the Cedo Rats. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Have you ever wished you could hear what you might have missed on Morning Edition, or All Things Considered? Well, as they say, there's an app for that. NPR One is a new mobile app for your Android or Apple smartphone that plays back the latest newscasts from both NPR and MPBN, and the news reports from NPR and MPBN news team that you might have missed. Not only that, but you can also skip ahead to the next report if you're not interested in one story. You can rewind instantly the last 15 seconds to hear something you might have missed or want to hear again. It's called NPR One, a new mobile app with both the latest NPR and MPBN news material available in the Apple Store or the Android Play Store, wherever, whenever, and now however you want.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the best and overlooked books of 2014. With me in the studio, Rick Russo, author of numerous novels, including the 2002 Pulitzer Prize winning novel Empire Falls. Bill Lundgren is a bookseller at Longfellow Books, a blogger and a teacher at Southern Maine Community College. Kate Christensen is also an award-winning author. Her most recent book is Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go to calls in just a second. But Bill, I want to ask you about nonfiction. We've really been talking about fiction a lot. You know, there was so much excitement a few years ago about Unbroken, and I think rightly so. And then a couple years ago, everyone I know was reading The Secret Life of Henrietta Lacks. Mm-hmm. Is there anything this past year that rises to the level of those two nonfiction books?
I mean, two of the nonfiction titles on my list are Furious Cool, which is a biography of Richard Pryor. That is fantastic. He was a cultural icon, but certainly he was also as tragically flawed as any character in Shakespeare. And then most recently, I read An Indigenous People's History of the United States by Professor Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who argues that this myth of colonialism is exactly that, and unless we recognize that colonialism is actually based on genocide and oppression, our telling of American history is a total lie. And, you know, as recent events in Ferguson and New York City point out, our justice system is not broken. It's functioning as exactly as it was intended to function.
Mm.
Yeah.
We're going to go to the calls. Chris in East Machias. Hi, Chris. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you very much. I have one book to mention, and that is The Book of Strange New Things by Michael Faber. He's an Irish author, and it's unlike anything else I've encountered in recent years. It's about an English pastor who lives with his wifey and their cat Joshua, has a small congregation, and he travels trillions of miles through space on the very strange group called USIC to be a missionary to a alien race on a planet called Oasis, which was named by a schoolgirl in Kansas or somewhere out in the Midwest.
And how do you spell the author's last name?
Faber, capital F-A-B-E-R, and his first name is spelled capital M-I-C-H-E-L, Michael Faber.
Great. We'll add that to our Facebook page post. Thanks so much for calling, Chris. Headed to North Berwick and Julie. Hi, Julie.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Oh, yes. Many of my friends told me to read this book, and I kept putting it off. I read two of her novels before. One was My Little Friend, and the other one was about snakes and the religion with snakes in the South, and I couldn't get through that. It was awful. So I was not awful. I just couldn't bear the snake part. And I was very reluctant to read her next novel. It's Donna Tartt, and it's called The Goldfinch. And finally, I read it. It is the most fantastic book that I ever read. It is so incredibly good on many, many levels. I read it in 3 days. I was reading till 2 o'clock in the morning. I love, love, loved it. So if your readers would like a real experience, it's called The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt.
That's a big, fat novel. You read that in 3 days.
I read it in 3 days. I stayed up till 2 o'clock in the morning and woke up at 6 to read it.
I did too, I have to confess.
Yeah. Now, I think technically that's 2013, but boy, a lot of buzz around The Goldfinch. Well-deserved. Would you agree, panelists?
Yes.
Oh, it's undeniably ambitious. When you read it, you can't believe it. And you really feel that it did take that long to write. It's not a novel that could be written in a year. And it's compulsive, again.
They've been telling me to read it, that I've been putting it off. And I'm dying to read The Paying Guest. I love Sarah Walters. I loved all her other books, too.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah. So I'll look forward to that. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Julie. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. On Facebook, some people have made posts. Patricia, The Narrow Road to the Deep North by Richard Flanagan. She writes, stunning is the only way I can describe it. Michael, how about Solon resident Peter Pfeiffer's memoir about how and why of becoming an independent tree farmer in northern Maine. It's called Hard Chance Tree Farming in Troubled Times. Central Maine is a buzz. It's a great read. And John Keimel, who's sitting across the window from me, loved Bread and Butter by Michael Wildgen. Is it Wildgen or Wildgen?
Oh, Michelle Wildgen. Yeah,
Wildgen.
I just read that.
Oh, Michelle Wildgen. And
that's
what
a terrific
do you think?
Book, yeah.
Okay, great. And it's about food, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry. So that's a nonfiction.
It's about three brothers who are all in the restaurant business in a small mill town in Pennsylvania.
Oh, it is fiction.
It is fiction.
Okay. I'm having people talking in my ears at the same time. Kate, sorry about that. I apologize to the audience. We're going to go to Surrey and Elaine. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I wanted to bring your attention to two memoirs that I've fallen in love with. And this first one is probably not really an overlooked book, but Gary Steingart's Little Failure,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which is a hilarious and very moving account of his family's move from Leningrad to Queens when he was little and growing up as the child of Russian immigrants in Queens. And it finds humor in the most appalling situations, and it's just a wonderful read. And also Mark Doty, the poet, wrote a memoir called Dog Years that came out a few years ago, and I can best describe it by the blurb that I read about it, calling it Marley and Me for the Cerebral. It's a wonderful book for dog lovers about the unaccount of his lover dying from HIV and their dogs and their life together. And that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Oh, thanks for calling in, Elaine. You know, and I think that a couple points here is, one, memoirs are really having a moment right now, aren't they, Bill? And more popular than ever.
Mm-hmm, they are. Well, there was Monica Woods when We Were the Kennedys, which was a huge seller and wildly popular. And then Rick and I were just talking about Men We Reaped, which came out last year. I'm going to let him talk about that. That's a memoir by Jessamyn Ward, who had won the National Book Award for Fiction the previous year.
Men We Reaped?
Yes, Men We Reaped. It's a wonderful memoir. It won't cheer you up, but it's absolutely essential reading now, I think, especially in view of recent events in Ferguson and the Eric Garman verdict yesterday. It's a book, and actually it's a 213 book, but we'll talk about it because it just came out in paperback this year, so it qualifies. I read it a year late. It's a book about the death of five young black men in coastal Mississippi, and told by a young woman who's asking the fundamental question: What is it that is stalking us, especially stalking young black men? Is it race? Is it class? Is it a nexus of the two? I was just thinking about this yesterday, as a matter of fact. When you read this book now, you'll have a glimpse into the desperation of poor blacks, especially in the rural South, but across this nation. And in view of what's been in the news recently, I found myself yesterday just thinking about the New York Staten Island case, the fact that a black man was choked to death using an illegal chokehold, that his dying words were, "I can't breathe." I think those three words sum up "Men We Reaped." It's "Men We Reap." It goes to the heart of what people are thinking and feeling in the black community, and of course it wouldn't necessarily strike white people this way, but a black man being choked to death in America in 2014 will remind black people of lynchings. And so if you're interested in the kind of despair that is part race and part class that is infecting black communities all over the United States right now, Men We Reaped will give you a window.
Headed to Portland, and my coworker Robin Rylette calling in. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
Good.
Well, I don't have a book from 2014, but I just finished the latest in a historical fiction series that was published this year. It's called Written in My Own Heart's Blood, part of the Outlander series by Diana Gabaldon. And when you finish a series, you're just sitting there going, well, now what do I do? So it made me think about rereading another series that came out, I think it was way back in the 80s, by a Scottish authoress called Dorothy Dunnett. And the series is called The Lyman Chronicles, and it's one of the most fascinating series I've ever read, Jennifer. It's the protagonist, Francis Crawford, is a 17th century Scottish genius with a classical education. And every time I've read these novels, there's six of them, I've read them three times now, I'm still compelled. And the guy is just amazing, and you never quite understand his motivation. You don't really always know what he's doing or thinking, but you know he's up to something. And the plot is just, to me, so fascinating from beginning to end.
Well, Robin, now that you've called, you must post this on Facebook. I know that you are a Facebook user, so you have to post both these series on. Will you do that? Thank you.
Don't have a Facebook.
Okay, well, send me an email. I'll put it on, though. Thanks so much. Going to North Berwick, and David in North Berwick. Go ahead, David.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I don't remember your guest's name, but I couldn't agree more with the gentleman who spoke about black men in America. I think this is our biggest challenge, is to change this country. And so I tend to read a lot of things in that area. But this year, I have to say, Goldfinch was the book I read this year that stood out the most. And I wanted to remind people of the classics. The best book I read this year was Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. So
definitely not a 2014 novel, but thanks. No,
it's what I read. I buy so many books, I don't know when they're.
David, thanks so much for taking the time to call. So do we want to talk about Crime and Punishment? Do you all agree?
We could. I used to teach it.
I used to teach it. Is it one of the best novels ever, indeed, Bill Lundgren?
Well, Raskolnikov, I always found him fascinating because Woody Allen made a movie about a guy who kills his wife. And at the very beginning, he's sitting and reading Crime and Punishment. And not a single reviewer or any of the discussions of the book talked about the parallels between the movie and the book, which was really strange to me.
Is a donkey beaten to death in the Woody Allen?
Yeah.
Probably not.
And the question is, when do we ever have a moral rationalization for just eliminating somebody from the face of the earth? That pawnbroker was a pretty evil woman.
I always think of him as the first genre writer, or one of them, or an early genre writer. Like I always think that he invented the detective novel in some way, or noir.
Yeah.
And that Raymond Chandler is a descendant of Dostoevsky, because ultimately the detective novel is a very moral kind of examination of crime and what it is. And I feel, and I also feel that Notes from Underground is a kind of early kind of loser lit novel, you know, the kind of black comic, antisocial. Novel of somebody at odds with society, and I feel like back then you could be taken much more seriously as a genre writer.
That's true. There is definitely a prejudice against genre writing, and it's always baffling to me why that happens.
Genre writing, and I just heard an interview on NPR with Mary J. Blige talking about music and how tired she was with having to worry about if her music fit into a certain genre for play on radio stations. So throughout the arts, a Facebook post from Anne, did you already mention The Martian by Andy Weir? So excellent. And my husband, who teaches high school physics, is going to have his students read it. Entertaining and educational. And we have The Right Word. This is from Martha. The Right Word, Roger and His Thesaurus by Jen Bryant, and illustrated by Melissa Sweet. It is not just for children. Adults will love it, too. Okay, headed to Beals, Maine. And Ray. Hi, Ray. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. The book that I'm recommending is My Father's Eyes by Mary Bonina. B-O-N-I.
Ray, could you speak up just a little bit, please?
Sorry. The book I'm recommending is My Father's Eyes by Mary Bonina, B-O-N-I-N-A. It's a memoir, and it's a gift from a friend. I'm 68, so I can identify with Mr. Rousseau's comments. I think he said he was 65, and he doesn't want to, I guess, take time to read something that he can't get into, so he puts it aside. Well, I find myself drawn to something like a memoir more than a novel or something like that, because it seems to be, well, it's from a person's real life, and I guess I have trouble sometimes with fiction because it doesn't feel quite real to me sometimes, and so So do you guys have a good memoir to recommend? This one here is about a lady growing up in the Worcester, Mass area, but she has a Maine connection. And her father has an eye disease where he's going blind, and I can't pronounce the...
Well, I'll tell you what, Ray. I invited the panelists here for their recommendations, but if you haven't read When We Were the Kennedys, you must, from Monica Wood. Go ahead, Bill.
There's another Bill Rohrbach's masterpiece memoir, Temple Stream, has just been reissued by Downey's Press. It's his story of his relationship with this river, the Temple Stream, that runs right outside the doors of his farmhouse up in Farmington. And it's part history. It's part, just his walks in the woods. A lot of it's about beavers. And it's fascinating. It's beautiful. And this new edition is gorgeous. It's got a cover graphic of Bill clearly in his canoe with his ponytail flying out behind him, his dog in the bow of the canoe, and they're paddling down Temple Stream.
Reminds you a lot of Thoreau. I love that book. But he has that kind of attention to natural detail, and he's just such a beautiful stylist.
Sounds like a great gift too. And that's one thing I wanted to get around to. Books that giving, it's such a personal thing to give a gift of a book, but it's such an appreciated thing if you hit the nail on the head. And it sounds like for somebody who's an outdoor lover or from the Farmington area, that this would be a great recommendation. Thanks for calling, Ray.
And we forgive Ray for his we forgive Ray
writers.
For his thoughts about fiction. And it's relative unreality. You're okay with us, Ray.
Speak for yourself.
I just hung up on him. I was going to go to our caller named David, but I've been told I have to take another break. So when we return, more of your comments and questions, please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Silly's in Portland's East End, open at 11 Tuesday through Friday and at 9 for brunch on the weekends with vegan and gluten-free options, sillies.com. And Androscoggin Bank, congratulating the Androscoggin Children's Advocacy Center, 2014 winner of the bank's 25K for Kids Award.
A visit to the place where you live near the Kalahari Desert in Botswana, where exotic wildlife is right on the doorstep.
We love it that we can take our young kids and go see zebras and warthogs and ostrich and giraffe just on the weekend or someday after school.
The border between the wild and the city in Habarone. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Join us for Living on Earth Sunday morning at 7. And join us this afternoon at 1 following Maine Calling for Alternative Radio. Today's speaker, Naomi Klein, journalist, author, and filmmaker who discusses capitalism versus the climate. That's Alternative Radio coming up at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what is on your reading list? We are talking about the best and overlooked books of 2014. With me in the studio, Bill Lundgren, a bookseller at Longfellow Books and teacher at Southern Maine Community College. Kate Christensen is the author of 6 novels, including The Epicure's Lament, the Penn Faulkner winning The Great Man, and The Astral. Her most recent book is Blue Plate Special. I'm sorry, Kate, I can't say that right. Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. Rick Russo is the author of numerous books. His 2001 novel, Empire Falls, won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Just reading your introductions, what an embarrassment of riches we have here in Maine, don't we, Bill? Wouldn't
it's
you agree?
True. It's amazing. The writing community here is, you know, I worked and taught in New York City for a long time, and I think it rivals the literary community there. I mean, there's certainly more people there, but there is just so many. Well, you look at the Kirkus Awards, 2 of the finalists were Maine writers, Bill Rohrbach and Lily King.
And let me say, as a judge, there was no nepotism whatsoever. They completely deserved it. Although I was kind of like, go Maine!
Well, and what I love, and tell me if this is the case in other places, I sense that there's a real community of support, not only through the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance, but the way in which all of you are always reading and talking about each other's books. You know each other. This is not a group of people who are sitting alone in a cabin in the woods eschewing human contact. This is a group of people that's truly a community. Am I right?
Yes.
It's astonishing. Having moved here from New York 3 years ago, and I mean, there are communities in New York of writers for sure, and everyone seems to know one another. But up here, it's so much warmer, and it's so much more personal, and maybe because it's a little smaller, but it feels like you can't throw a spitball without hitting a great writer in Maine. And I don't throw many.
That's right.
I could throw one in this room and hit a great writer.
Well, and I feel the same way, too. I lived on the coast of Maine for a long time, and of course, there's some great writers on the coast of Maine, too. And I really enjoyed my time there. But coming a couple of years ago to Portland, being welcomed into this writerly community here was at the time special, and it remains special. And I just like the fact that writers here don't stand on a lot of ceremony. We all tend to like each other a lot, and you know, I don't think we're in competition with each other. We just enjoy you know, we enjoy
drinking together.
I was trying not to bring alcohol into the into the conversation,
you know,
but here it is. Here it is. So. Yeah.
Well, next time I have you on, I know what to supply. Okay, so David has been hanging on since before the break, and David, returning to the thoughts on Crime and Punishment, right?
Yes, I didn't do a very good job of making the connection I had hoped to make, that the class warfare that went on in that novel is very much like the race problems we're having in this country, and I think we can see an awful lot of reflection both in the government side and in what the decisions and people are having to make. And the fact of the matter is there's a great deal of crime and punishment being meted out by our government. So that's the connection I was trying to make, and I guess I didn't do a very good job with it.
No, I think you did. Thanks for calling back, David. We have a Facebook post from Marguerite. She writes, I read all the books your expert panelists recommend and just finished all of Kitteridge. But thanks to a lovely program MPBN aired earlier this year featuring an author I thoroughly enjoyed, I must recommend a charming little book entitled Does God Sing? A Musical Journey by Aaron Robinson. I'm not sure it'd be considered an overlooked book since most of my friends and family will be getting it this Christmas. Thanks for all you do. I'm already making my list from your program today. Well, thank you, Margie, for the lovely post. Do any of you have a book in which you are buying 20 and giving them to everybody?
This new collection by Ron Rash, Something Rich and Strange. He's a Southern writer, and he's a writer's writer who really hasn't gotten the recognition he deserves, but he's an astonishing writer. Every single story is set in this small county in western North Carolina, a la Faulkner, but the universal themes that come through are just eloquently stated. And he maybe will get the recognition he deserves in February 2015. His novel Serena is going to come out as a movie with Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I want to second that. Ron Rash is an absolutely gorgeous writer. And he suffered. We were talking about the ways in which genre writers sometimes don't get the due. Well, regional writers, too. What we think of as regional writers. We don't think of New York as a region, but regional writers like Daniel Woodrell and like Ron Rash tend to be given short shrift. And they're two brilliant, wonderful writers who should not be thought of as Southern writers. They're just great writers.
Well, it's interesting, too, that you talk about regional writers often given short shrift, but the analogy was to Faulkner.
Yeah. Right. The most regional of writers, yeah. who's also the most universal. That's the weird thing about it, is you think that if you're writing wonderfully specifically detailed books about a particular region, that therefore you're not universal, whereas in fact the exact opposite is true. The more specific something becomes, the more vividly specific something comes, the more likely it is to strike readers as universal.
I totally agree with that. I think that's so well put, and you really articulated something that I read for is a sense of character and something very particular that then grows like one of those little sponge things that you put in water and turns into a big dinosaur. After you finish reading, it sort of grows in your mind, and you realize how big it really is.
Yeah, when I was a younger writer, and my first couple of books were upstate New York books, and I thought, boy, I better get out of here pretty soon because I'm going to be tabbed as a regional writer. And of course, it's been the biggest gift I could have received is to realize that that's not true. And if I keep going back to this place that is so vivid in my imagination, it's just going to continue to reward me.
And the sense of place becomes this rooted kind of, I mean, I find this in all great novels in a way. Look at Middlemarch.
Yeah.
And your novels. And the novels that could be seen as regional are often the geography and the small town. Olive Kittredge is another one.
Yes.
Is used to sort of talk about the world.
Right.
And it's a prism.
Right.
And it's not small at all. And it's
absolutely
not regional.
Yeah.
We're going to go to Standish and David. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to thank the panelists, first of all, from Longfellow Books for being an amazing independent bookseller. We're so happy to have him in town.
You're here?
You're here.
And the book I was recommending, it might not be entirely overlooked, but I'm not sure if the entire audience knows of Haruki Murakami in his book of 2014 with an incredibly long title called The Colorless Tsukuru Tazaki and His Many Years of Pilgrimage.
All right. That's come up on shows we've had before, so you're not the only one. Thank you so much for your recommendation, David.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Headed to Brewer and Margaret. Go ahead, Margaret.
Thanks for taking my call. And I have three, if you have time, but they're all nonfiction.
Go ahead.
Okay. One by Ben Montgomery, which I think came out just this year, 2014, is Grandma Gatewood's Walk.
Oh, yeah. I've heard about that.
Yes. I think she was a grandmother already when she walked the entire
Appalachian Trail. Yep.
Oh, it was a fabulous book. And then another one, which I discovered, was Martha White, E.B. White on Dogs. And I think that came out in 2013. And I think she was E.B. White's granddaughter. Mm-hmm. And she collected some of the things that E.B. White had written about dogs and put them together in a very delightful book, and there are the photographs in it, too.
Margaret, you'll be thrilled to know that in January we're going to talk about E.B. White on the Maine Calling Book Club, so I hope you'll take part in that.
Okay, January, you said.
Yep, the January Maine Calling Book Club, toward the end of the month.
Oh, good, good. And then, is it one particular book of his?
Oh, we're actually going to do something different and talk about his writing in general. But go ahead, Margaret. What's your third book?
Okay, the third book is something that I just read for the second time, and it's by Doris Cairns Goodwin, who just came out fairly recently with The Bully Pulpit.
Mm-hmm.
But the one that I really, really liked, and it's on my all-time favorite list of books, is Wait Till Next Year. It's a biographical about when she was growing up in Brooklyn. And I loved it the first time, and then someone just returned my copy to me, and I read it the second time. And she is writing about her family and the Brooklyn Dodgers. And it's a really, really fun read, but very easy. It's not heavy like a Bully Pulpit.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Margaret. And Bill is nodding and smiling, a favorite of yours as well.
It is. It's about this young kid who's in love with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and then they break her heart by moving to Los Angeles. Lovely book.
Thanks, Margaret. Headed to Portland. And Nancy, hi, Nancy, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was calling in regards to maybe an unbiased site that you can go to and get recommendations for books if you want to put in a genre or something that you kind of want to look for that you're not quite sure what you're looking for. And I was wondering if your panel had any suggestions on some websites.
Indie First is a great website.
And Bill, I was wondering if you could tell me if your other book about the gunshot love songs was only based on the Green Bay Packers coming from that area.
Hi, Nancy.
I was just curious, though.
I don't think there's any mention of the Patriots in the entire novel, so I don't know if you'd enjoy it.
Is this a segue into?
I'm thinking about this. We're in Maine, right? Okay. Nancy, thanks so much for calling.
But is this a segue into talking about Steve Allman's book against football?
We could talk about that book. I mean, I just had dinner with Monica the other night. And we were talking about football, which is dangerous because we are
especially with Monica. Yeah,
we have allegiances to different teams. But I was talking about this, you know, this conflict I'm going through because all of the negativity about football is really striking home. But at the same time, I'm watching this quarterback for the Packers who is he's transcendent. It's like watching a Greek god. He's just playing at the top of his game, and I can't not look.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't not watch it. But
I think the problem is that we don't want to look when these same heroes of ours can't feed themselves at the end of their lives because we're not anxious to watch that.
That's true.
But I think it's an important book. It's a very funny book, and it's written by a fan. Steve Allman is a huge, huge football fan, or was. And he finally got to the point where he simply couldn't anymore. And it had to do with concussions, which the NFL is trying to do something about right now, but also about the lesser known aspects of the sport, the accumulation of hits that don't rise to the level of concussion. And it also, you know, I just think if you're the parent of a kid who wants to play football, either Pop Warner or high school, you really should read this book because you don't want to let your kid do that unless you know what the risks are. And the younger you are, the risk of significant brain damage, cognitive impairment later in life is huge because a kid's brain doesn't fully fill his skull yet. And so when he gets hit, it's like a pea rattling around inside the skull. And I mean, the statistics for high school kids being killed playing football are off the charts.
And this is The End of Football by Steve Allman?
It's called Against Football.
Against Football.
By Steve Allman.
All right.
It's a beautiful little book.
Huh.
Disturbing.
Wow.
We'll get some calls on that.
No, well, we're almost out of time, so we won't. They'll come in after the show's over. We're going to go to Auburn and Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I would just like to... book I'm reading, Think Like a Freak by Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner.
So these are the guys that do Freakonomics, yep.
Yes, absolutely. And two main authors, Crash Berry, Elizabeth Peavy, and I'm just going to throw in before I hang up, it's sort of retro because they're previous to 2014. I love Edgar Sawtelle by Wroblewski, and Teachings of Don Juan by Carlos Castaneda, which I go back and reread. I thank you so much for your show.
Okay, thanks so much, Paul. Final thoughts before we do split and get away from the football calls. Anything we haven't mentioned that we have to in the next 30 seconds?
Can I just throw a quick plug in for one of my favorite YA books, young adolescent books I read last year, which was Fog of Forgetting by Genevieve Morgan. Perfect Christmas present for the young reader on your list.
I totally agree. I read it too. It's wonderful.
And a wonderful lady. She's one of our favorites here on Maine Calling. Well, thank you all so much for returning to Maine Calling. And Kate, welcome. Kate Christensen, the author of 6 novels. Her most recent book is Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. Rick Russo is the author of many novels, including Empire Falls and Nobody's Fool. Bill Lundgren is bestseller at Longfellow Books and a teacher at Southern Maine Community College. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/maincalling. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. And don't forget, for this month's book club, we will be discussing Cheryl Strayed's memoir, Wild. Get your copy from your local bookstore and join our discussion. The book is coming out as a major motion picture, and the Maine Calling Book Club is Wednesday, December 24th. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.